If the partner you're working with insisted on doing all the dealing himself, would you simply stand there and watch what was going on?
Oh, yes. Yes. Mm. You would, but it used to get very frustrating. Let's say one had quite a lot of friends by then who were similar age. They were pretty terrified of the partner, and they didn't want to approach him, and they wanted to deal with me anyway, which was good for me, because it brought business to the firm. Mm. Whereas if I hadn't been there, he could be at times a bit unapproachable, they were frightened of him, so they'd have gone and dealt with the opposition. Mm.
Did you feel he lost a lot of business that way?
I feel I gained a lot of business by dealing with the younger generation that came to me. Mm. And I think that was appreciated in the end, it was realised that I was bringing business.
Do you ever have to refer back to the partner?
Oh yes, oh yeah. I mean, if it was a big one, if it was a big order, I mean, suppose I made a price and market's in 10,000, they said, well, it's 100. Mm. Oh yeah, I wouldn't deal with that, not with him standing there, that would have been wrong. I might stick my neck out and say, well, I'll make it due in 25, but if they said they were bigger than that, I'd say, well, I'd better ask the governor, and I would do so. Mm. After all, it was his money I was gambling with. Oh, yes. Mm. Mm, definitely that.
And what was the next stage after being authorised?
I was made a member. That was quite strange how I was made a member, because I didn't have the money for membership. You had to have two sureties as well to put up money as well. And talking to colleagues over coffee and that, they said, well, there is a list you put your name on, and you might have to wait 10 years, but after that period, every now and again, every year, if there's not too many members coming in paying the full fees, if one's done, which I suppose one could call an apprenticeship, they pick so many up to become a member without paying the full fee. And after about 1959, in fact, it was, this came up. My name was on the list of about six people who could become a member without paying. You had to pay your fees, but without the surety business, without the full thing. So you didn't have to have a nomination, that's what it was. You didn't have to have a by-nomination, which was then about £1,200. So it was quite a lot of money. You still paid the full fees and had sureties. And I didn't even know my name was up there. And a senior partner of a broking firm we did a lot with came over to the pitch, who he knew my two partners very well, he was older than them, and he said, oh, I see Colin Knox's name's up for membership, I shall be very cross with you and I shall never deal with you again if I'm not to be his main surety. And he stormed off. So of course they were shocked. They said, what's this? So I told them, and I said, I've had my name on there for several years and it's come up, and Mr. Heath has offered to be my surety. And they said, well, how much will it cost us? So I said, well, I don't know fully. It's full membership, but I don't have to have a nomination. So they said, we'll think about it. And about 3 days later, they said, OK, we'll do it. So I was made a member.
Mm. And this was in 1959?
Yes.
And what did that involve for you in terms of your work?
Enormously. Enormously. In fact, after that, when we had our own firm and we continued the firm continuation, as soon as we had a good year, if we had a couple of guys that were youngsters who were eligible and they're any good, I'd insist on making them members. Mm. Mm. Because it's prestige for the firm. Mm. It's a great prestige for them. Mm. Not so much today, not in the last 5-10 years, but it was an enormous prestige to be a member as opposed to an authorised clerk.
Mm. What kind of place was the Stock Exchange at this time during the 1950s?
It was the old building. Still had the old teak floor, which was about 3 inches thick. The waiters used to come around with the watering cans twice a day and water the floor to keep the dust down. Mm. It was lovely, absolutely lovely.
Mm. And what about as a group of people? Were they? Did you feel that they were forward-looking, or was there a lot of? Were there a lot of traditions?
Awful lot of traditions. Mm. Awful lot of tomfoolery. Some very severe characters, except one of my partners was one of them. Very severe people. Certain people, if you trod on their toes, you'd be upstairs before the council. I mean, really picked on you, you know.
Did that ever happen to you?
In point of fact, it did. When I was a member of about 4 weeks standing, I was going down to the main member's toilet, which was like a privilege to go to, which was a lot better than the others. And I bumped into this gentleman with his wing collar coming up the stairs the wrong way. He was rather deal bigger than I was, and bumped into me very hardly. And I didn't apologise, because it was totally his fault, and he didn't apologise. In fact, he said, "Who the hell are you with, boy?" But being a member, which I wouldn't have dared done before as an authorised clerk, I dashed at him and I said, "I'm with Pryor and Williams. Would you like to come and talk to them?" He never said another word, because he'd have met his match.
And can you remember any of the traditions?
Such as?
Well, you said that there were lots of traditions.
Tricks,
they played. Tricks.
Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, there was an old boy who used to sit on the pitch between Pryor and Williams and Goldsmith's brothers, who were a funny old couple of lads. One was a bit off his rocker, a nice old boy, but a bit off his rocker. And this old boy used to sit there every day between the two of us. And I think he was with a company called Spooner. He was a one-man firm, so they were disallowed about a year or so later, because you had to have two partners in a firm. And for some unknown reason totally unknown to me, he was about 70-odd then, he was known as Bum. And Bum used to sit there after his lunch, and he was one of these chats that we call spoon-fed. He didn't make prices. A broker would come up to him and say, "I want to buy 2,000 ICI, and he would go around and buy them and then charge the bloke a penny and make 20 quid. He was spoon-fed. And every day without fail, about 2:30, he'd open the Times to read it, and it'd be set alight without fail every day. He would doze off behind it and someone would light it. That never failed. And there was the old guy that used to, I think it was Seymour, was terrified of trading. And he had a brother, the older brother, who was quite good at it. If anyone approached him, he'd shake like a leaf and say, "Wait till my brother comes down." He wouldn't trade at all. The old boy that was with us, Beavis, who'd been in the First World War, used to point out people to me. When I was a blue button, indeed. "Who do you think he was?" And he'd tell me what he did during the war. "Who do you think that was?" And I said, "I've no idea. Who do you think this is?" And one day a little guy came in with his mat turned up like that, hands in his pockets, creeping through the market. He said, "What do you think he was?" I said, "A spy." He said, "How did you know?" And I think the fellow's name was Blenner Hassett, and he was the first British spy to be dropped by parachute. There's all sorts of characters. He said to me, "Who's, you know that firm Frisbee Brothers?" I said, "No," because the job was, so many jobbing firms, and outside your market, you didn't know them. I mean, you knew the Gilded Age market was there, but you didn't know a soul in the firms. He said, "This is Frisbee Brothers." So I said, "Oh, yes." He said, "That one's the Coward." So I said, "The Coward?" He said, "Well, they were both in the war when I was, the 1418 war." So I said, "That's a bit unkind. Why is he called the Coward?" He said, "He only got the military cross. His brother got the VC." That's true. That's absolutely true. So many characters like that. It's unbelievable.
You became a member in 1959.
59, yes.
And you continued to work on the foreign bond pitch.
Stayed on the foreign bond pitch the whole time.
And what was the next...
Next step, I suppose, about 63, 62, 63. Douglas Tribe and I, who were both members, he was a 2 year senior to me in age. We both had offers from other companies, and it gradually got round, and they saw us talking, and only five of you standing together, it became pretty obvious. And we go out and talk to people and that. And the partners obviously got wind of it. And one afternoon, we'd both been out for lunch with people, which we didn't have long lunches in those days at all, but we'd had a couple. And the senior partner then called both of us to him, and he said, it's quite on the cards that in the foreseeable future, one of you or both of you will be made partners. And that was his way of saying, don't go up, presumably. And about 6 months after that, they said they're making us both partners.
Why were you looking for other firms?
Money, basically. money, basically, it was it. We were low paid. Mm. We were low salaries from what the salaries were for what we were doing as member dealers.
Mm. Did you get a lot of toing and froing between firms?
Not so much with the jobbing firm, no. Mm. With brokers, yes. Mm. But not as much with jobbers, no. Not as much. But we weren't going to an opposition firm. It wasn't done. I mean, it wouldn't have even been allowed in those days for us to go to Meadwin or Paul Shaw or something like that. It wouldn't have happened. It would have been very nasty had you done that. Mm. But there were other offers. I had an offer in the option market, which was just starting, and a couple of other offers, one with a broker. Mm. My colleague had two offers, one with a jobber, but it wasn't in our market, so that would have been acceptable. And they, I say, after a few months, they made us both partners.
Mm. And what did partnership involve?
Not a lot. First thing we said, we were both married with houses and young families. Mm. First thing we said, what are our salaries? Well, what are you getting now? They didn't even know, sort of thing. Mm. We told them. And they gave us a drawing power of up to double that. But then you didn't know whether you had a bonus to come or not. I mean, you could have ended up owing money, I think, you know, mm. and it wasn't too lucrative at all. Mm. And that lasted for about 2 years. Business had dropped off quite a bit, still making money, and they both decided, well, they told us they were thinking of packing it up. Mm. So we had the option of carrying on the firm, which we didn't have any money, mm. or joining another company.
Mm. Why were they thinking about packing up the firm?
Well, I think they tried to expand it. I think they tried to expand and they couldn't get anyone comparable to go with or anyone wanted them comparably. They couldn't get a match. Mm. They tried. I know the firms they tried and they couldn't get, it didn't cotton on. Mm. So they both decided, with the knowledge they had and a lot of friends, to go broking.
Mm. When you say they, are these the brothers?
The two brothers. The father was then dead.
Yes.
So they went to a large broking firm, where our relations were quite good. I dealt with them quite a bit after that. Mm. Douglas Tribe and I had the option of staying on with Pryor and Williams, where we had two other partners, but they weren't on the foreign book. They were older men doing the Australians, right? They thought that as one of them was nearing 60 and the other one was in his late 50s, that it would be their capital that would be at risk. Mm. And they didn't know us all that well because we were kept separate from them. Mm. And they said, we're not doubting your abilities, but you can't make anything as much as those two have. And we said, well, we think we'll make more. Mm. Why? I said, well, because we've got a lot more friends. Mm. Certain business wouldn't come to us, but a lot that didn't come to them would come to us. Anyway, we sort of, you know, tossed it over for a few weeks. And they said, we think it'd be best if we join someone else, because if we pull out in a few years and leave you to it, you'll have no capital. So we joined the firm of White and Cheeseman.
Mm. What sort of firm were they?
They dealt purely in banks and insurances, nothing else. Mm. So we were totally alien to them. They had about five partners, and we took four, making nine. We all shared a nice big room together with all the modern equipment as it was at the time. And it didn't work out because the market they'd had was an easy market. The banks had all been giving rights issues and they were offered a block of shares, so they made money all the time. They couldn't lose. But as soon as that stopped and the competition they had was WED, and other big firms, they kept losing money. Mm-hmm. And they kept losing money to the extent that after about 2 years, Douglas Tribe and I had a debit in our partnership account through no fault of our own. We hadn't drawn the money. It was just our share of the losses. Mm-hmm. And we spoke to the two that had come from Pryor and Williams with us, Grant Coleridge and Ken Ling, and we said, we just can't afford, we've never owed a penny in our lives. Mm-hmm. We've got mortgages, we've got families, we just cannot go on. Mm-hmm. We're making a lot of money and all they do is lose it. I mean, we just don't like this debt.
Mm. How was it that you'd come to join them in the first place?
Well, because we needed capital. And the four of us together could have stayed as Pryor and Williams. We'd have made, with hindsight, a lot of money and stayed as Pryor and Williams. But as they were nearing, they were in their late 50s, they didn't want to risk their capital, not knowing what we were going to turn out like, being on our own. So we joined them to get more capital, which didn't work at all.
Had they been looking for someone to merge with?
That's what I'm getting at. We're doing that all the time.
And you'd discuss things informally, would you? Or how would you make contact in the first place?
Through a broker originally. It's normally done like that, through a broker. Because we didn't know the firm of White and Cheeseman, or the partners indeed. And they were a very nice crowd, very nice people. But I'll say after 2 years or maybe 3 years, we were just, it was banging your head against a brick wall. And there was no sign of them making any more money. I mean, it wasn't the market they'd known. It was so easy. It wasn't easy anymore. So we decided to separate. And we said we'd have to give them notice and go. And they said, well, they're not doing very well in the end. They said, well, look, we'll leave you the firm. We'll go.
Had you brought your foreign bond book with you?
Yes.
So you'd stuck to
that. No one else touched it.
Yeah.
No, Douglas Tribe and I did all the foreign bonds. No one else touched it. So we reverted back, although the name was then White and Cheeseman, it's really still Pryor and Williams, because we gave up the banks and insurances and just kept with the foreign bonds and stocks and the Australian shares.
What did the old partners from White and Cheeseman do? Where did they go off to?
One retired. The second senior came with us. He put some additional capital in to the bit we had and the other two partners had. He came with us and stayed with us till he died. He was a lovely man, Jim Hamilton. And one went into insurance and the other one took a pub.
Was it a very different firm to Pryor and Williams?
Yeah, they were, they were, apart from the senior, well, even the, from the senior, they were younger. They're a very friendly crowd, but it had just gone against them. It wasn't their fault. The market that they'd known, which was so easy, so with new issues all the time, where you made threepence a share whatever you did, had gone. So there was no way they were going to make money, and they knew that. They couldn't do it.
So you carried on White and Cheeseman. And about
correct.
About what time was it? What, about when did this happen?
I think about 1966. Yeah, about 66. And we had quite a few good years, continued like that. We had one or two bad years, pulled ourselves out of that. And then we did quite well for several years, made another couple of partners up. And then one went, and then we made another two partners up, youngsters who were with us from school. And we were White and Cheeseman when we were taken over by Guinness Mann.
Which was?
Part of Guinness Peak Group.
Yes. And when did that take place?
3 years ago, I suppose. And they put a director with us who worked for us years ago before he went to Australia. Then came back. There wasn't a job for him. He'd gone into banking. He was with us for about a year down there, less than that, actually. And then he decided to move on. And we were then taken over to go into Guinness Mann's office. We came off the floor, which we all, well, at least I hated doing. The youngsters thought it'd be a good idea and they regretted it, but it was inevitable. And then Tony Jenkins' firm, they were looking to be taken over and had several approaches. And in the end, they were taken over by the same group as us. So we sat in an office together, although did our own books. And then a couple of years ago, my young director I worked with decided he'd like to make a move, and he and his assistant were going to join Jenkins, which we're quite happy to have them, because he wasn't doing much on the book he'd been on. And I thought I'd be happier, as I sort of brought him up from a boy, to go with them as well. So I saw John Jenkins and said, two are moving to you, what about me moving? He said, lovely. So I moved over as well.
And again, roughly when was that?
About 2 years ago.
2 years ago. Well, we'll go back in time again now to the late 60s. How did you actually run the firm? Was it a big firm to start with?
What, when we joined White and Cheeseman?
Well, the point where the old White Cheeseman partners...
When they went out, no, it wasn't, because we had offices in Pinner's Hall at the time. We had to get rid of about 4 staff, left us about 10, I think. Mm. 10 staff. There were 5 partners, 2 blue buttons and a dealer. So that was the extent of the firm. And we warned them that there wouldn't be a rise for a year. There probably wouldn't be any bonuses for a year. Mm. In fact, after about 6 months, we were doing very well. Mm. They got a good bonus. And then the next year, we did extremely well. And we treated the staff very well. Mm. And 100% bonus. The next year, they got 100% bonus. Mm. We had thoughts of expanding, and we thought, well, this is damn silly. Doug Tribe and I had done the book we'd been doing since we were 17, 18. Mm. We knew exactly what we were doing. Mm. Why go into another market? Mm. But of course, the jobbing system was never over flush with capital. Mm. Never over flush. It could always use more capital. Mm. And by then, we got enough to jog along quite nicely. Mm. We had 1 or 2 setbacks. There was a setback in 1970. A mm. Setback in 74. But we overrode those, and then a lot of the jobbing firms that had been in the foreign market had disappeared entirely. Mm. In fact, there was only Merwin and Lowy and ourselves left. Paul Shaw had gone, Aubrey Sperling, Wissman, Black and Boyd, they'd all disappeared, Wolf Christie, and Lemon Bristow, there were loads of them. And Medwin and ourselves, which would, as Pryor and Williams had been the biggest two, we were still going strong. They dealt exactly the same stocks we did, every foreign bond we dealt in. And then where we had an Australian side, Australian industrials, they had Americans and Canadians, so they were very comparable. Mm. Similar size, they were slightly larger in numbers. And when this boom came in the foreign bonds, which was mainly brought about from the Scripofoli market, and they leapt to extremely high prices, which they never saw again. Whether it was that entirely, or whether the Canadian market it might have been, an American, but they got into trouble. And they've been quite a rich firm. But mind you, they'd lost senior partners. And as senior partners go out, a big chunk of the money was going. Mm. And they'd lost 1, 2, 3, 4 seniors. I still think they'd been as financially viable as we were, but they obviously took a bigger tumble, either on the foreign bonds or the Americans. I don't truthfully know. Mm. I think it was the foreign bonds. But they came out of it very badly. And must have been in a mess, and went to WED and asked them to help them out. So WED took them over. Mm. I mean, which is a very small thing to WED to take over a company that size. And they kept them on for a couple of years, and then they gradually packed up the foreign market, so we were the only ones left. Mm. So we got all the business.
So for much of the time before this firm went out, there was only one jobbing firm you were competing against?
For a long while, yes. And for quite some years.
How did that work in practice, actually on the floor of the stock exchange during the normal course of dealing?
They had their friends, we had ours. You get other people that just wanted to deal at the best possible price and would go all around the market, back and forth, however many jobbers there were, whether it was 2 or 10. But basically, our friends we dealt with for years always came and dealt with us, and their friends dealt with them. Really, it's as simple as that. Mm. It was a case of personalities. But we got on quite well with them. Going back about 7 or 8 years, I suppose, John Thurlow was a senior partner, retired, and I got on very well with him. We had a mutual respect. We weren't friends. We both had a mutual respect for each other's knowledge and what we did. And to an extent, whereas you hadn't done this years before, you talked a bit. Mm. You could talk to each other more.
What would you talk about?
A situation where I would, whereas before you wouldn't approach people many years ago, I'd go with him and say, John, I think you're making entirely the wrong price in that stock. Mm. Whereas before you didn't do it, you were pig-headed about it. You just didn't talk to each opposition. Mm. Mm. And he'd say, why? I said, well, I think you're dead wrong. I'm willing to buy stock from you at that price or sell stock to you at that price. Mm. And then he'd say, oh, maybe I'm a bit out. No, I'm not wrong. But you talk. Mm.
When you say you had your friends, do you mean you had brokers who only came and dealt with you?
Oh, yes. Not the majority.
Yes.
Not the majority. The majority of brokers, especially if they didn't know the market, would check their price of however many market makers there were.
Even when there were just two of you.
Yeah, but you'd get friends that would only deal with you anyway. Mm. And, I mean, the last thing you would do would give them a wrong price, because if they found out that you'd given them 93 and they were 95 bid elsewhere, they'd never deal with you again. So you just didn't do it. It was a mutual trust.
Mm.
It's the same as having, you're making a price on the pitch and you make 72-3 to someone.
Mm.
And the next chap, he doesn't deal, hasn't traded, so you haven't changed your price, 72-3. And that chap says, well, I say 70-5.
Mm.
But you just made him 2-3. I say, oh, that was him. Now, that's happened about 6 times in my life of 40-odd years.
Mm.
And the chap would say, well, why is the price so wide to me? And I say, well, don't you know?
Mm.
Because he was a crook. He was a wrong'un.
Mm.
And he'd pick you up as soon as look at you.
Mm.
And you don't do that more than once or twice.
Mm.
And then they get stamped.
Mm.
And he'd say, well, I don't know what I've done wrong. I said, well, you go away and you think about it.
Mm.
And then he'd either come back and say, I apologise, let's start again.
Mm.
Or else you'd never see him again. But I would imagine that's happened to me 6 times in 40-odd years.
Mm.
So that's not bad average.
Mm. Was the foreign bond market affected by the same kind of factors that affected the gilt market? For example, a change in bank rate or devaluation?
No, not at all. You'd look at one or two stocks. You might look at a couple of fixed interest stocks like Spanish 4s, Jap 6s maybe, and alter them a shade, but only a shade.
Mm.
But it wasn't affected by Wall Street.
Mm.
That sort of thing. Obviously, when you had the Suez crisis, yes, because it knocked the bottom out of it.
Mm.
And then again, when we had the other crisis after that, Cuba, that hit the market for 6 because everyone was selling.
Do you have any particular memories of dealing during those periods, during Suez or Cuba?
Yes. Every time you opened your mouth and made a price, you got more stock.
Mm.
So you had to keep dropping it.
Mm.
So then you not only widened out on your price or lowered your price, you cut down the size of the market. Where you make it in 25,000 or something, you say it's in 10.
Mm.
And if you bought another 10 and another 10, then you drop it again and you might have to say it's in 5.
Mm.
Oh yeah, you had to do that because the capital wasn't there to keep supporting to buy and buy and buy stock.
Mm.
Well, we had big positions. For a small firm, we used to have some very big positions.
Mm.
But it was always covered. But you had to make sure it was covered.
Mm. Were you affected by periods of falling prices in the stock exchange generally? For example, in 1974, when prices collapsed?
Yes, very much so.
Do you have any memories of that time?
Well, the main reason was, really, that people would look at their portfolios and see that their industrials had dropped so much, and they'd look at the foreign bond market, if they had foreign bonds, which a lot of people did have, and think, well, these haven't dropped all that much.
Mm.
Or I doubled up on my position 2 years ago when they were low, and I've got a profit, and they'd sell those to retrieve money to pay the other off, you see.
Mm.
So, yes, you still, the market dropped.
Mm.
Yeah.
Were there any particular boom periods that you recall going through?
Oh, those on. I mean. the first boom period, would be the Japanese boom, when everyone was buying Japanese bonds all of a sudden, and they made the settlement. And that was extremely busy. I mean, we were there till 8 o'clock at night in the office.
Mm.
Every night, 5 nights a week till 8 o'clock.
Mm.
That was very busy. And then when that was settled, it switched to the German settlement, which was very busy and very, very heavy trading. And it would flit about. There was nothing consistent about the stock market at all.
Mm.
You could be as busy as hell 1 week and then nothing doing the next week.
Mm.
But those periods then were quite long.
Mm.
Extremely busy times, yes.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah, very busy. And then Australian boom again, because when that got very busy, the Australian market, I was seconded over to that. We were in a different part of the market then.
Mm.
It was the old post office, which the stock exchange owned. We went over there, and I went on the book there for 6 months or so, because they were so busy and we were quiet on the foreign book.
Mm. And how did that actually work in practice? It was just simply more people wanting to deal on Australian government bonds.
Yes, you had the Poseidon affair and things like that.
Mm.
And Tasman X and all these other companies that were going. And there was a boom all of a sudden in the oils, Woodside, Oil Search, all this sort of stuff. And it was the Christmas, I don't know what the year was now, gosh. It was a very, very, very busy one. And then after that came the huge slump.
Mm.
74, I suppose. That would have been it, I think. And then, I mean, you couldn't cope with the bargains. You were doing so many bargains a day. It was all you could do to book them.
How did you find that yourself, being a dealer on the floor of the house? Was it physically tiring?
No, it's lovely. You're only tired when you're not busy.
Mm.
No, I loved it. I mean, the old adrenaline starts to flow. The tiring bit is when you stand there all day and you're not doing any business.
How would you cope if there would be three or four people wanting to deal at the same time?
Well, you just have to. They'd have to wait. Because, don't forget, there were, four or five jobbers then in the Aussie market, really. Time they'd left you, because they couldn't wait and push their way through the crowd to get to the next guy, they'd have to wait again. So the simplest thing to do, if it was that busy, was deal. Otherwise, you'd never get your orders done by the brokers or us. So they mostly just dealt.
And were there any other booms that you recall after that? You mentioned the Scripopoly.
Scripopoly, yes, that was a boom, yes.